Your name is what? My name's Steve Thompson. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is August the 18th, 1982. You applaud yourself, you know. And I've been wrong a lot in my life, but I have never been more wrong than I was on that date. Because on that date, I believed that all the doors to life were closing. And in fact, all the doors to life were opening for me. I want to thank you all very much for the invitation here this weekend. It is my understanding that at least in part, I'm here at because of a suggestion made by Harlan Petter. I don't want you to think less of me because I know Harlan. And I hope after this talk is over, you don't think less of Harlan for having made the suggestion. And I want to thank you for the wonderful fruit basket. We drove up from our home, and when we got here, we were greeted by that, and it was wonderful to have that, to have some snacks and some refreshment after the drive. And I am a member of the El Reno group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Strangely, it's located in El Reno, Oklahoma, about 25 miles west of Oklahoma City, a community of about 12,000 hardy individuals. And while I did graduate from high school there and am a member of that group, most of my drinking over the last 8 years of my drinking was done in the small community of Calumet, Oklahoma, a village of about 500 people, half of which are my wife's relatives. When you drank the way that I did in a village of that size, it gives a whole new definition to the meaning public drunk, I can tell you. The El Reno group is where I found sobriety and where I found a sense of belonging and a sense of love. I don't know that anything sets it apart from any other AA group in the world, with one exception. We do not and have steadfastly refused over the last 16 or 17 years to have business meetings. The last one we had 17 years ago almost had the entire group drunk, so we just decided not to have them. But we do have a steering committee that looks after the business of the group. The current steering committee is made up of a fellow named Dean R., who is the past U.S. trustee at large for Alcoholics Anonymous and also my sponsor, a fellow by the name of Nick the Knife, One-Eyed Mark and his wife Weird Rhonda, and me. And we take care of the business of the El Reno group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to extend a warm welcome to my traveling companion for the weekend, my wife Linda. Linda, if you would, please. Linda has, to the best of my knowledge, only one idiosyncrasy and one outstanding defect of character. The idiosyncrasy is that you just never know what she's going to say next. This morning, we were at breakfast, and the lady came around to pour the water for our table. And she said, after she was gone, she said, "Gee, that looks like a nice career." I had never thought of it in that way. I'll give you another example. I went to my first AA meeting on my 15th wedding anniversary. Linda didn't much care where I went at that point in our marriage, but I did go on, and I went to her and said, "Well, honey, I'm going to go to an AA meeting tonight, and I'm going to try to stay sober. every expectation. Listen, if I seem a little distracted up here today, it's because I'm only about halfway through Jenny's talk, so I'm... She talks a lot faster than folks from Oklahoma can listen, I can tell you that. Anyway, I went to Linda and I said, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. I'm going to try to stay sober. Every expectation of her saying, that's so wonderful. I'm so glad you're going to go and you're going to get sober. I'm just so proud of you. That's what I thought she would say. What she said was, you thought that was funnier than I did. I went to that meeting. And I am very, very fortunate. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I walked in the door. I heard a fella early in sobriety say at a meeting, he knew that he was unique and different from other folks in the world because of his highly developed sense of sensitivity, his great intelligence, those kind of things. But he thought, surely, there must be someone of the billions of people that there are in the world, there must be someone just like him. And when he walked into his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there they all were. Same highly developed sense of sensitivity, same great intelligence, but a feeling of belonging. So I went to that meeting, and then I went to a meeting the next night, and then I went to a meeting the next night. I had a lot of time to go to meetings. I was unemployed and living off the good graces of Linda, and I would have starved to death had it not been for her. But I kept going, and the days turned into months, and the months turned into years, and the years went by, and on our 25th wedding anniversary, she gave me a watch. And the watch had an inscription on the back of it. And the inscription said, "Thanks for 15 good years and 10 wonderful years." Well, I thought, too. And I have this really, really, really bad defect of character that I want to take things that are already good and try to make them better. So I said to Linda, "Linda, did you really think that the first 15 years were good years?" Every expectation being that she would say, "Oh, honey, it wasn't as bad as you thought. It was really wasn't that bad." What she said was, "No, but I couldn't get him to put shitty on the back of the watch." I should tell you about the day that I learned about Al-Anon. I started going to these meetings, and shortly thereafter, Linda was invited to go to the Al-Anon meetings, and our daughter, who I dispute, Joe, why I have the most beautiful daughter in the world, was 10 years old, and there was an Al-Anon meeting at El Reno at that time, and so we began to go to meetings as a family. And that was terrific. That was really neat. But I had been in the program for about a month, and I was visiting after the meeting with an old timer one night. I guess he had about 3 months, and he said to me, "You know why you drank the way you drank?" I said, "I don't know. You guys are talking about a disease or something around here. I don't know." He said, "I'll forget all that stuff. You drank for the very same reason that I drank, because of your wife." And I thought it was important for her to know. And so, in the car on the way home that night, I said, "Honey, do you know what's his name said at the meeting tonight?" And she said, "No, what did he say?" And I said, "He said that you were the reason that I drank. And I thought it was important for you to know that." Well, she'd been to Al-Anon, and my daughter had been to Al-Teen, and she looked at me and she said, "Well, let me tell you something, big boy." She said, "I didn't cause you to drink, and I ain't going to cause you to stop. I'm going to go to Al-Anon and make the best life for myself that you can, and you can do whatever the hell you want to." And in the back seat, up jumps this 10-year-old blonde head that says, "That's right, Daddy." Y'all find this stuff funnier than I did, huh? And I was sorry that I'd brought it up, and I have tried not to bring it up since. Although it is, Al-Anon, particularly Al-Anon newcomers. I mean, I don't know how it is everywhere else, but Al-Anon newcomers will come running up to me and say, "We were crazier than you were," as if they expect me to argue with that. But there is terrific power in that program. And our life together, I know, would not be what it is today were it not for that program. And so while we do tend to have different personality types that are attracted to one another, it is in fact my second favorite program. I don't know if you had a place, your favorite drinking place, but I did. About 15 miles west of El Reno on the old 66 highway, there was a roadhouse, and the name of the roadhouse was the Four Pillars. Now, obviously, this roadhouse was operated by an alcoholic because the four pillars were four old creosote posts that were holding up a porch, holding up the roof to a porch that was about to fall in. But it was a wonderful place, wonderful, wonderful place. It was outside any municipal jurisdiction. They sent the county deputy out there one time to break up a fight, and the fight had broken up by the time he got there, so he just joined us. We just had a few drinks, and he wrecked the cruiser on the way back into El Reno. So the county sheriff refused to send anybody out there, and the highway patrol had no interest in it, so we just drank until nobody was there to drink anymore. It was a wonderful place. There was a fellow that ran it. His name was Billy. He was about
this tall.
And he grew his hair out about a foot and a half on this side, and he would swoop it around in an Elvis Presley pompadour. And he wore those gold sunglasses, like Elvis used those big rim sunglasses. And he had a little speakeasy door. And you'd walk up and you'd knock on the door, and he'd slide the door back and look at you, and he'd close it and let you in. I don't know why he did that. Hell, he never refused anybody, you know. But that was Billy's deal. And this place had red kitchen carpet that squished when you walked across it. You know, I mean, I never, ever saw Billy clean this place up. He would open a new bottle of Pine Sol and rechristen it occasionally, you know. He'd just give it one of these. It had a parquet dance floor and red Naga hide upholstery and a Wurlitzer jukebox that played George Jones and Willie Nelson and Patsy Cline. And we used to go slug that dadgum jukebox, and we'd go out and we'd dance, and it was the most wonderful place. But of all the songs that were on that jukebox, my favorite was Ray Charles's rendition of Born to Lose. Born to Lose, I've lived my life in vain. every dream has only caused me pain. All my life, I've always been so blue. Born to lose, and now I'm losing you. I'm going to tell you something, folks. If you can't stay drunk to that, you ain't trying, are you? And about 6 months before I got in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that place burned to the ground. And while they've never been able to pin it on her, our first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. And for people that are not alcoholics, no matter how hard they try, nobody will understand the depth of that admission. Alcohol was my friend, and it was my friend from the first time that I drank it. And for a long, long time, until it did in fact turn on me. The first time I was born out in the country west of El Reno and went to a small country school. To give you some idea how small this school was, I was a salutatorian of my eighth grade graduating class. But there were only two of us in the class. Louis Jean Funk was the valedictorian and I was the salutatorian. And when I graduated from... You know, I still put that on my resume. Salutatorian. When I graduated from there in the eighth grade, I went to El Reno to high school. Now, folks that live, you know, in big places, that may not mean much to you, but I went from that environment to a school that had 800 students in it. And I was about the same height that I am now, and I weighed about 110 pounds, and I had those competition orange pimples, and I had a shock of white hair that was uncontrollable. It would look pretty good now. I think it would be fashionable now, but it would just go in different directions. And I used to take some stuff called butch wax. Remember butch wax? Butch wax was the stuff that you're supposed to make your hair stick up, your flat top stick up. Well, I'd take about a jar of that butch wax and I'd paste my hair down, and it worked. It worked for about 2 hours, and then suddenly my hair would spring to life and it would glisten. And I was in this big school, and I was not susceptible to talking to anybody, and I hated it, and I hated them, and I hated me. I did not belong. But my mother, bless her heart, was always trying to convince me to get out and meet people, and that I was as, you know, as good as her child, her darling, was as good as anybody, and to get out there and meet people. And so the city of El Reno, the Junior Chamber of Commerce members had a dance for the kids every Saturday night, and they hired a live band, and it was the same live band because they were cheap, and they were cheap because they only knew two songs. But they would hire this band, and we, the kids, would all go sing, and so go dance. And so I would, I was there one night at my mother's insistence over in the corner, and just miserable. And a fella that had gone to this little, one of the big boys that had gone to this little country school with me, came by and said, why aren't you out there dancing? And I said, I don't feel like dancing. And he said, you want something to make you feel like dancing? And I said, yes. And we went out to the trunk of his car and got out the biggest bottle of cherry vodka I've ever seen in my life. It was probably a pint, but it just looked big. And he said, take a drink of this. And I took a drink of that cherry vodka, and he said, now take another drink. And I took another drink. And to the best of my recollection, that's the last time that anybody ever had to ask me to take a drink. I took a big old pull off of that, the third big old pull off of that cherry vodka. And he was right. I felt like dancing. And as I was walking into that dance, I could feel my hair floating into place. And I looked down on that 110-pound frame, and I watched the muscles grow. You know. And those competition orange pimples fell off. And I went into that dance, and I grabbed some poor, unsuspecting 14-year-old, and we went to the dance floor, and we danced. I did the mashed potato. I did the swim. I twisted again like we did last summer. It all looked pretty much the same. But I danced. And people began to back up. And I thought, my God, I'm a natural dancer all my life. And all I needed was a little of that stuff in that purple jug to inspire me. And they backed up farther and farther, and hell, they were just afraid they was going to get hurt. That's all they were. And I kept going back out there, and I kept feeling better and better and better and better until sometime during the night, I stopped for some reason in the middle of the doorway of that place, and I looked up, and when I did, I puked purple right straight up in the air. And it rained down on me. And I had on a white T-shirt, and to this day I believe I invented tie dyeing. It just and I don't know how I got home or what happened or anything about it, but I do know there ain't nothing I don't think more pitiful than 14-year-old cherry vodka puking drunk hangover. But all I could think about was that wonderful time I had out there on the dance floor. And I wanted more, and I wanted more, and I wanted more. And I went in hot pursuit of that feeling for the next 20 years. And the only thing that happened was the good feelings got less, and the bad results of alcoholism got worse. And I will tell you that I was a pretty constant drinker who had episodes. And on August the 18th of 1982, but I would come off of one of these episodes, and I would look as closely as I could, and somewhere off down in the distance there was a little beam of light. You know, if I could get the arsonist straightened up, and if I could get my creditors straightened up, and if I could get the judge straightened up, and if I could get my employer straightened up, and if I could get my employees straightened up, if I could get them right, then I would be okay. And I would head toward that little beam of light. And then I'd have another episode after some constant drinking. And I'd wake up, and I'd look, and there it was. Now, you could see it down there. It kept getting a little farther and a little dimmer, but there it was, if I looked long enough. And on August the 18th, when I woke up that day, no matter how hard and how long I looked, I could not find that beam of light. And I knew that this was what it was going to be like. And so I called the one person that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous, who happened to be my dad, who had 20 years of sobriety at that time. Okay, Dad. He had 20 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, and he came down to my house, and he looked at me, and he said, what the hell do you want? Well, I called, and my mother answered the phone. And I said, I need to talk to Dad. Would you ask him to come to my house? And she said, yes. But as she was hanging up the phone, I heard him say, tell the little SOB I ain't loaning him no more money. Boom. But he came to my house, and he said, I only have one question for you. I said, I got to quit drinking. I got to quit drinking. You know, Linda's leaving, and I'm losing the house, and the bank's taking the business, and I just got to quit. And he said, I don't care about that stuff. He said, I want to know one thing. He said, do you want to stop drinking? And I went through this diatribe one more time. He said, I told you, I don't care about that. What I want to know is, do you want to stop drinking? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, you don't have to take another drink one day at a time, as long as you live, as long as you will go to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and apply that to your life. And he said, but I will tell you this much, I ain't sponsoring you. He said, you'll get me drunk and you drunk and the group drunk and the whole damn thing, and out the door he went. Pretty soon he was back and he said, I've called this guy and he's going to come out and talk to you. Don't drink. And out the door he went again. Pretty soon he was back. He said, there's this blue book we read. I've loaned mine to somebody else, but here's Dr. Bob and the good old timers. Read this. And out the door he went again. And at this point I was thinking, you know, it's a good thing I'm getting into this organization because they clearly need my organizational skills. And they sent a fellow by the name of Big Al. He's about head size, out to my house to talk to me. And he walked in the door, and I thought, I've got this AA deal figured out. They send some big guy out there, and if you start to take a drink, he follows you around and cuffs you. Bam! Now, don't drink. But I'll tell you what Al did. He talked, and he talked, and he talked. And I'm sure he said, you know, you got to go to meetings, you got to read the big book, you got to work the steps, you got to do all that. I'm sure he said all of that. The only thing that I remember from that conversation is a story that he told about himself where he said, you know, I knew that I had to stop drinking. I knew I had a drinking problem, knew I had to stop, but there was a dance at the VFW. And I thought, you know, this is before he got in AA. He said, I'm going to stop, but if I'm going to go to this dance, I'm going to have a drink just to loosen up and enjoy it. And he said, I went to the liquor store and bought a half gallon of vodka in order to go to that dance. And when he said that, I said, there is someone else like me. There is someone else like me. And it was from that beginning that I began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our steps say that we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I have no story to tell you relative to that than other than what those people in the El Reno group told me that day. And they told me to ask God to keep me sober one day and to thank him at night when that happened. And as that very simple exercise of a God that I'm not even sure, I hear people talk about resentments against church and strongly not believing in God. I have no idea where I was in my spiritual life, except maybe at zero. Maybe at zero. But from that very simple exercise, my faith began to grow. Because you know what happened? One day at a time, I wasn't drinking. I wasn't having continuous drinking problems, nor was I having episodic drinking problems. One day at a time. Now, I was still crazy as a goose, but I began simply to practice that little exercise. Our third step says we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. And I struggled with that because I was looking for the big event. Did y'all ever, in your pursuit of a spiritual life, look for the big event, the big whatever it was that was going to prove to me that I had made that decision? And Jenny talked about that today. And my dad saw me struggling with that. He is not my sponsor, but he did see me struggling, and he was free with his advice. And he said, read the step. Read the step. What does it say? And I said, it says, made a decision. And he said, stop. Stop. Can you make a decision? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, I've been in AA for 20 years. I've never seen anybody have a perfect spiritual life. But he says, all you have to do is make that decision that you want it. And I said, okay, I've made that decision. What now? And he said, now you get on with the rest of this program. And I said, And I thought, oh, hell, because I cheated, I read ahead. And this business of an inventory and going and telling somebody, I just simply wasn't going to do. But I had made a decision. I kept saying that simple prayer. And finally, I sat down after some duress from both my dad and my sponsor. And maybe the first evidence of a growing relationship with a power greater than myself was during the fourth step, because I simply said, God, I can't do this without your help. Please help me to do this fourth step. And I began to write. And the story that emerged was the story of a guy that did what he wanted to do, when he wanted to do it, in spite of who it hurt, until somebody in authority stopped him. That was the story of my life. And I read that to mean self will run right. That's the way I read that. And so, now I will tell you that all of this time that all this was going on, I was, on occasion, someone would, from this little town, would casually say to me, you want a drink? And my reaction to that was, and to run. I mean, I just couldn't deal with the notion of that. But I took this fourth step when it was completed, and I went and took a fifth step with a Catholic priest, as a matter of fact. And he was a fellow that was taking those fifth steps and had taken several of them. And shortly after I took my fifth step, he took a vow of silence and went off to live in the woods in Maine. And immediately everybody that had taken a fifth step with him took credit for it. You know, it was my story that sent him to the woods, you know. He happened to be the chaplain at the federal penitentiary at El Reno, and I suspect our stories were kind of like short beer drinkers compared to some of the stuff that he had heard. But I took that fifth step in all the honesty that I could muster, and shortly after that, you should know that the first job that I had in sobriety was as a part-time janitor at the school where my wife was principal. She would, little kids getting mashed potatoes on the wall. And she'd walk by and she'd say, clean up those mashed potatoes. And I'd say, I won't tell you what I'd say. And then after that, I was a ditch digger. I had an old trencher when I got drunk one time and bought a lumber yard when I didn't know a 2x4 from a Buick, and had $150 in the bank. And that old trencher was the remains of that lumber yard after I drank it up. But I was out after the fifth step. This is a long way around to this, but after this fifth step, I was out doing a job with that old ditch digger, and a fellow walked out and he said to me, do you want a beer? And I simply said, no, thank you. Simply said, no, thank you. And I had loaded up that old machine and was on my way home when I realized what had happened. And to this day, that is the greatest miracle that's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The notion that gnawing, ever-constant, ever-present desire for that drink, that uncontrollable desire for that drink, at least for that day and that time, was gone. The greatest miracle yet to happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The sixth and seventh step talks about defects of character, and I want you to know that I take the program of Alcoholics Anonymous very, very seriously. And as a result of taking it seriously, I have had every single defect of character, every one of them, removed from my life. You seem skeptical. with the exception of one. I have one remaining defect of character in my life, and that is that I think about myself damn near all the time. You know, that self-will run riot that was revealed and talked about in the fourth and fifth step is my constant companion. It is my constant companion. And all I know to do is to do what we do in this program. Because my sponsor has a favorite thing he tells me, in self, in trouble, out of self, out of trouble. And if I am helping or carrying the message to you, I am out of self. I am out of self. It says we make amends, and I went to Linda and began to make my amends to her, and because she had been active in the program of Al-Anon, she made her amends to me, and that was the basis of what I think has been a pretty good life ever since. I went to my dad and said, I started to make amends, and he knew exactly what I was doing, and he stopped. He said, I don't want to hear it. Just don't drink, you little SOB. You know, that was his, that's what he called me, little SOB. You know. 10 says that we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admit it. And I tend to do that, or try to do that through the day, but most generally I do that at night when I have little conversations with God. And we review my day, and as we review my day, there are things that I have done well, he tells me, for me. He says, that wasn't bad for you. And things that I have not done so well. And then he tells me, if I owe an amends, I'd better go make it, because things will pile up on me, and I will drink again if I do not. But the last thing that the God that I have come to understand through the program and through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the last thing that he says to me every night before I go to bed is, I love you. I love you. You are a part of my universe, and I love you. And if that is, when I have that kind of God, that's the kind of God that I want to talk to, and to listen to, and to ask what to do, and ask for the ability to do it, because I know on my own unaided will, self-will will again take control. And very simply for me, that is the 11th step. Talking to God, listening to God, asking for God's direction, and asking for the power to do it, because on my own I will not. My dad used to say in meetings, pretty similar to what Jenny said today, this morning, in her beautiful talk, he would say, they would ask him to share on the 12th step in meetings, and he would simply say, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and that don't mean maybe. That don't mean maybe. If you will take these steps to the best of your ability, you will develop the kind of spiritual life that will allow you not to drink one day at a time and have a reasonably happy and sane life. And when I was first in the program, I thought, bless his heart, is that the best he can do? I'm a college graduate, and he is not. And I will go and I'll read these books and I'll do these things that they say to do, and I will come back and tell them the real meaning of that first part of the 12th step. And I discovered it. And I'm here to share it with you all tonight. And it is, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and that don't mean nothing. If you will work these steps to the best of your ability, you will find a spiritual way not to drink one day at a time and have a reasonably happy and sane life. And the second part says, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. And all I have for you today is that. I was a bad old drunk. I was brought into the loving arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried to work those steps to the very best of my ability, and today I have not had a drink today, and I have a reasonably happy, sane, and sober life. That's my message. That's my only message to you. If I tried to tell you any more, you would recognize that I am out of my league. And then it says, we tried to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I will tell you that I heard somebody in an AA meeting said that they had done research in the Big Book, and there were 137 principles listed in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got to tell you, folks, to this day, I can't keep track of $137, you know. But I do know this. I do know unselfishness. I do know tolerance of others. I do know love, and I do know forgiveness. And if on the day that I can practice those, I will be well on my way. I will be well on my way. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was unemployed and unemployable. And, well, let me tell the story. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't filed an income tax return in 4 years. And it was just easier not to somehow. I was on those times when I wasn't drinking episodically, just drinking constantly, you know, I would try to do it. I just never could get around to it. And I was sitting at home after I'd been in the program for about a month, and a fellow from the Internal Revenue Service called me. He said, Mr. Thompson, our records indicate that you haven't filed an income tax return in 4 years. And we were wondering about that. And I'd been in the program long enough for about a month that I'd heard somewhere in a meeting the word patience. And so I said to this Internal Revenue Service agent, well, if you will just be patient. Now, if you're new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you find yourself in a similar situation, let me give you some advice. Do not counsel patients to the Internal Revenue Service. They do not take it well. And he began to mention places like Leavenworth and El Reno. You know, at least I was going to be close to home. And he scared the heck out of me. And I jumped in my old pickup and I ran into my sponsor's law office, and he had a client, and I just went barging in. I said, Dean, I just got a call from the IRS, and I haven't filed an income tax return in 4 years, and they're threatening to put me in the penitentiary, and what do you think I ought to do? Now, my sponsor to this day has never said to me, this too shall pass. Oh, for the day that he says this to you shall pass. When I said I haven't filed an income tax return in 4 years, what do you think I ought to do? His response was, hell boy, I think you ought to file them. I never would have thought of that on my own. I'd been sober 2.5 years, and I was still doing, you know, part-time janitor work, which is, don't get me wrong, it's wonderfully honest work, maybe the first honest work that I'd done ever in my life. But I became resentful about the fact that I just thought these jobs weren't what I was about. And one day I was just in a rage, and I knew I was going to drink over it, and so I went rushing into his office, and I said, you know, you keep coming back, keeps getting better, blah, 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 blah. And I've had these jobs and what, and I'm sick and tired of it. And I just went on and on and on, just in an absolute rage. And he finally let me just sort of, you know. And there was a moment of silence followed by, have you ever thought about applying for a job? Oh, yeah, there's that. And he said, you go over and you apply with state government with the state of Oklahoma. You don't have to know much to work for them. And I did, and the famous thing happened. I got a job. And the first job I had in state government was as a tax auditor after this other thing. You know, we talk about God having a sense of humor, our higher power having a sense of humor. And I did that for a while, and then they came to me and they said, it was at the Department of Agriculture, actually, they said, we're starting a natural resources unit. And I said, well, I don't know anything about that stuff. And they said, neither does anybody else over here. You might as well try it. And so I said, okay. And I did that for a couple of years. And then the job for the director of the department came open. And they said, I knew it was open, and there were a bunch of people that had applied for it, and I went to the auctioneer and said, what do you think I ought to do? And she had been listening to Dean. She said, well, I think you ought to apply. And against 64, 65 other people who had much better credentials and much more experience in that kind of work than I did, I applied for that job and interviewed, and about a week later they called and said, would you like to have the job? And I said, yes. Damn right, I'd like to have the job. And then 6 months later, the legislature abolished the agency. But I don't think that was my fault, because shortly as that was happening, they were creating a new environmental agency in the state of Oklahoma called the Department of Environmental Quality. And in the interim, Governor Walters asked me to be his deputy secretary of the environment. And then the new director of the much larger, much more comprehensive environmental agency in Oklahoma asked me to be his deputy, and I've been doing that for the last 9 years. And Tuesday, in the wake of his retirement, I interviewed with the Environmental Quality Board, and beginning July 1st, I will be the new executive director of the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality. Now, it is impossible to get from there to there. It is not possible. And yet, here I stand. Evidence of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mentioned my daughter briefly. She went to Alateen, and she began to get some basis of spirituality in her life, but unfortunately, at the age of 13, she turned into the Antichrist. And that went on for a while. And then at the age of 18, she came to me and she said, I decided to go into the ministry. And it's all... I don't even try to understand it anymore. I just, you know, I go, okay, fine, you know. And she went off to the University of Oklahoma and got her bachelor's degree, and then went to Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky, and got her Master's of Divinity. And while she was there, she met another student of divinity from Tennessee, a bony-butted hillbilly from down south of Nashville, and they decided that they were in love, and they got married, and they graduated, and they came back to Oklahoma, and are now both Methodist ministers in the state of Oklahoma, both in small towns. She has decided to take a bit of a sabbatical from that to be with my two-year-old grandson, Sayer, who is the, well, how many grandparents in the room? Okay, great. I got pictures. You got pictures. Meet me up here. And all the things that I missed with her, I'm getting to do with him. And she doesn't even resent it. You know, she doesn't even resent it. The arsonist and I, we go places together, we do things together. We are not going to try to wallpaper again, I can tell you that, together, but we have a great life together. And so I can't imagine that things could be better, but you know, there are valleys in our lives too. My mother is, while very strong and very active, can no longer drive, and Linda retired two or three years ago from teaching after 31 years of teaching, actually, and so she had some time. Her mother is in the rest home and requires a lot of care because her mental capacities are diminishing rapidly and has some difficulty knowing, and so the efforts that Linda goes through to do those kind of things, I think, are most admirable. And then my dad in the last about 10 years of his life, he went through a series of operations. He had two heart surgeries, stomach surgery, kidney surgery, hip replacement surgery, and a series of strokes that left him unable to do those things that we normally think about caring for oneself. And we made the decision to put him in the nursing home that was his home for the last 2 or 3 years of his life. And but 2 or 3, and he died, it'll be 4 years Thanksgiving this year. And but a few days before he died, my mother, and he would have had 40 years of sobriety this month, had he lived. My mother was wheeling him down the hallway of the nursing home in his wheelchair, and in a clear and distinct voice that he had been unable to use for a long, long time, he broke into song. And the song that he sang was, "Count your blessings, name them one by one. Count your blessings, see what God has done. Count your blessings, name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what God has done." In the midst of all of those problems, my dad understood that he had been delivered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And whatever had gone on in his life physically since then, this was not only the frosting, this was the cake. My dad had a level of faith that I have glanced but have not grasped. He has a level of faith in his higher power that I have seen but do not understand, but hope someday to have just a piece of it. Just a piece of it. If you're new or nearly new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a miracle waiting for you in this room or rooms just like this. I hope you keep coming back to get yours. Thanks so much for having me.